Hello, you lovely lot. I wanted to take a moment to share an exciting announcement with you all. I will be doing a live show for Happy Mum, Happy Baby at the Podcast Show in London on the 22nd of May. This will be a live episode of this very podcast featuring me and a very special, soon to be announced, guest. Get ready for a candid conversation, unfiltered truths, laughs, invaluable non-judgmental advice, and lived experiences. Dive into the complexities of parenting while juggling work, relationships, and personal growth. And we'll be talking beyond the baby years. As well as the live episode, the show will also include a Q&A with both me and my guest. Tickets go on sale this Friday the 26th of April at 10 a.m, but anyone who is part of the Happy Mum Happy Baby newsletter will be getting early access to tickets on Wednesday the 24th of April at 10 a.m. To sign up to the newsletter and for more information about the event, please head to happymumhappybaby.com/events. I can't wait to see you there.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Happy Mum, Happy Baby, the podcast. Today's guest is a presenter we've seen on our TVs so much. She's also the host of a podcast called Midpoint, which is middle-aged and unashamed. I love just that tagline. It's brilliant. She's also the mum of two kids who are 17, Reuben and Lois. It's Gavvy Logan.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Very good.
You've got a very good tagline.
Middle-aged and unashamed, yeah. It's about more than being kind of beige and wearing elasticated waistbands. That's what I kind of wanted to. At the beginning, actually, going right back to the start of the podcast, it was more about the challenges of life when you get to the point where perhaps you're looking towards empty nest, kind of, you know, the future, and what you're going to do with your life in terms of things that you might want to go into that you've never had a, you know, time to do before, or taking a leap into a new career. And it's evolved into all sorts of areas. There's so much health-related stuff about midlife. Life, you know, the menopause stuff that's been a big conversation, and taboos being broken down. So it's been a lovely space to be, actually. And
is it really refreshing having those conversations that maybe aren't out there?
Yeah, and feeling that they're now more likely to occur in places that, you know, previously they didn't. And people are very much more mindful about the workplace, how that affects midlife women, and the kind of provision for you know, midlife health, I think, is really important as well. So, I'm, you know, as you mentioned, Reuben and Lois are 17. So in a few months' time, they'll have finished their A-levels. And so I am my target audience. It was a completely self-serving podcast.
Sometimes you've just got to make what we need.
Exactly.
How are you feeling about that new phase of life?
Really mixed. Reuben won't be here after the summer. He's definitely going off. Lois will have a year off. She wants to do some stuff. She rides and she wants to do stuff with horses before she goes to uni. So they're very kindly phasing themselves out of me. I think if they've both gone
out of
off,
your life.
Yeah. And then there was a possibility they'd start university on the same day and both leave me at the same time. And that would have been just dreadful. We do have moments, Kenny and I, where the house is eerily empty. They're both somewhere else, you know, that night or away at the weekend. And we go, oh, this is the future. And it feels so quiet and there's so much space, not just in the house, but in our minds. And, you know, you kind of realise the good things are the possibilities of doing things and saying yes to things that you previously wouldn't because of the kids. And obviously there's lots of downsides, and I really enjoy their company, and I love hearing them chatter and talk. And but they're not going away forever, you know. It's just that kind of feeling of waking up in the morning and not having the structure to your day as well.
Yeah.
Which
you've not got any kids to get up and out of the house and just to encourage out the door.
Yeah, but you know, when you first have children, I said something the other day, when they go to school, that was the big moment where it really hit me, like a kind of, you know, oh my God, somebody else is telling me when we can go on holiday, when we can, you know, when we can have lunch together, when we can. So school life becomes the structure, doesn't it? Term times become the structure. We've had that for the last 14 years, that structure of, you know, somebody else is kind of telling you what your timetable is. And it's that idea that we could go on holiday in September, if we really wanted to. And so that'll be weird. I said to Kenny, do you think we'll start getting up? We'd get up about 6 now. We have to get them on a bus at 7. I said, do you think we'll start getting up later? And he's like, no, it's really good to get up early. But I said, yeah, but we don't have to, you know.
There's that whole mentality, isn't there? If you get up and make your bed straight away, then as soon as you woke, within the first minute of waking up, you've achieved.
Yeah.
You've done something.
Yeah.
And I think if there is, you know, if we have a Saturday where we don't have to get up, the kids might get up and wander down and make themselves breakfast. But it is that kind of lazy morning.
Yeah.
And if you've got that all the time.
Yeah, I mean, we'll still have jobs.
Well, of course. Let's not forget. The
world
still
have to go to work.
Exists.
But neither of us are on that kind of 9-to-5 schedule. You know, Kenny runs his own business and does lots of other things. And obviously my job can be at weekends. It can be, you know, away. So we're not on that kind of in the train at 8 o'clock in the morning type kind of routine. So as my son said to me the other day, you escaped the rat race, which I've never thought of it like that. But we have a different kind of rat race, I guess. You know, we have different kind of leanings on our time. So we'll still have work, but I just really love their company, you know. And I was driving home from school. Normally they get the bus, but my daughter's got a driving test coming up, so I went to school to pick her up so she could drive home in her car. And my son was in the back seat, and he's not as close to his driving test, let's just say that, as she is. Okay. And he was just being so funny and made me laugh so much all the way home for about 35 minutes that I kind of like, oh, I want to just kind of, you know, he won't just want to ring me up though and have a chat.
Well, what are they like? If you're not together, say you're away for work or whatever, what are they like at keeping in touch?
Lois is she's really very organised and a constant texter and WhatsApper. So, you know, she'll be telling me stuff all the time and this is happening and, oh, could you just order this for me? And I've got this going on. And what will you be doing on this date? She's really organised like that. And so she keeps in touch well with her kind of texting and her WhatsApping, and she will call me. Reuben, if he's in the room, he'll happily jump on a FaceTime, but he would also happily go 2 weeks without having heard a word from me, you know.
Oh my gosh, this doesn't fare very well if you're going to be sending him off to uni. You're not going to hear from him until Christmas.
The only thing that I'm kind of hoping is that he'll need some cash at some point, you know, and he'll run out of cash. So, and he's also promised to bring his washing back, which is brilliant news. He's not bad. He'll send me little messages every now and again, or we'll have a dialogue, you know, kind of a conversation on text or an email. It's funny, they come to me for one kind of set of problems and they go to Kenny with other challenges. You know, they'll come to me all their academic stuff, anything that's going on relating to school, I get emails about from them. And Kenny's very much, he controls their, you know, when they had Go Henry's, you know, those cards that you can put top up and stuff, before they got their other accounts, he was the one that controlled those. So if they wanted more money and he's always had their phones on his phone as well. So if they wanted an app or if they wanted some more screen time, you know, so he'd be the one they go to for that. So, so we have different roles. And also they know who's picking them up from rugby training or from the horse yard or all those different things. So they do contact you about different things. You don't often get a random, I love you, I hope you're having a great day.
Oh.
But occasionally you do. And, you know, that they're lovely ones to get.
But that's the thing, isn't it? That's going to be the shift when they're not with you. It's going to be calling you not to kind of go, Mum, I need this, or, you know, any stuff
practical.
Practical. Yeah, it's going to be a kind of, hi, how are you doing?
Yeah.
Kind of thing. Hopefully, that's the call that you want.
Yeah.
You don't want a I need help situation, you know. So there's going to be that shift in even that dialogue.
Yeah, and actually already they do, like last night in the car, Reuben was saying, well, how was your day today, Mum? What did you do? And, you know, they do ask about my day and what I've been up to. So I hope that carries on and they, you know, they keep kind of interested in the family dynamic. And Kenny's said to them that whatever happens for the rest of their lives, there has to be at least 1 week a year. And it doesn't matter how many, you know, kids or husbands or wives they've got, we all have to go on holiday for at least 1 week a year. That's the rule. So, and I'm sure it'll be more than that because, you know, until they can afford their own holidays, I'm sure they'll be happy to jump on ours. But they're very kind of wedded to the area we live in. We've been in this area for about 10 years and they love all their local friends. And yeah. the idea of me kind of, you know, us selling up and going on somewhere else, Ruben's like, but yeah, but I want to come back to my mates. And so they like the kind of anchoring of home, and they love yeah. they love where we live, you know, so that's a positive. They love this yeah. area. So hopefully that
Do you think that will also cement you in where you live? Because a lot of parents, mm. when their kids move out, they look around, like you were saying about, you know, it feels really big and like there's yeah. just a lot of air in yeah. the space yeah. now. Like, but, do you feel like that? Is just you want that home to stay there in case they ever need to come back, and also to have that base.
I have a romantic notion of, you know, having grandchildren running around the same spaces that they had, you know, when they were little. But that could be, you know, if these are, I mean, I'm hoping yeah. it's not going to be 20 years, but it could be 20 years, you know. So I've got to be practical about things, haven't I? And we'll see how we get on. I could start kind of just bringing in waifs and strays and letting anybody come and...
Why not? But it is a funny thing, actually, because I can remember my mum and dad moving out of our family home. I mean, they separated, so that's why they decided to move out. But it is that thing of simple things of going to your parents' home and not, like... Being able to just go into your family home and get the biscuits out when yeah. you're having a cup of tea, like silly things yeah. like that, it still feels like yours. Whereas now when I go to their places, I feel like it's theirs and I'm
yeah.
a guest.
Yeah, that's interesting because my mum is about to knock down our family home and build apartments. So she wants to stay living on the plot, and yeah. she's going to take, you know, the kind of top apartment. And my parents also are separated, but that house... is where I moved to when I was 10. So I'm exactly how yeah. you were, you know, when I go home, even though I'm 49 and I'm not hungry, I open the fridge. That's literally yeah. the first thing I do, because that's what I did every day after school. And I see my kids do exactly the same thing. And even their friends, like if they've got a few friends who spend so much time here, they open the fridge on their own when they come to the house. So I love that idea that, you know, that they can just feel that kind of that affinity. Where all my mum has totally cleared out. I mean, she's so funny. When I was buying my first house in London, this van arrived and it was just boxes and boxes of schoolwork and all sorts of medals and things that she clearly felt guilty about not throwing in a tip, but she, you know, but she didn't want to keep any more at home.
Now it's your problem.
Yeah, exactly. So I do feel when I go home, the ground floor of my house, my parents' house that we grew up in, feels like home. Upstairs, all our bedrooms have been, you know, redecorated and are not no longer the kind of childhood memories that sits, you know, sit yeah. on the walls and stuff. But it does feel like somewhere that you immediately know is home, you know, which is
yeah. Which I wonder how that's gonna feel when it's somewhere new, because obviously externally, yeah. it's still the same views that yeah. you would have looked out.
Yeah,
to as
but
a
other
child.
People
yeah.
are living there as well, you know. On that, I'm pleased in a way though that she is doing that. It's going to be hard work. I mean, she's 72, but she is in property. It's going to be a hard project for her, but she's got loads of energy. But I'm pleased she's staying in that spot, because sadly that's where my brother died, in the garden there. And I think there's a bit of her that there was a tree planted on the spot he died, and it's now over 30 years. And the tree is, as you can imagine, it's huge and thriving. It's a weeping willow. And I think there's a bit of her that always wants to be able to see that tree from wherever she lives.
Yeah.
Sorry to change the tone there. But yeah, I think that I'm pleased she's staying there, because that'll be the place she stays till, you know, till she's no longer here.
Yeah, absolutely. Gabby, what was your childhood like?
My childhood was super happy, with lots of activity, moving around a lot. My dad was a football manager, so we moved, and football player. We moved cities and schools and houses. I think I lived in four houses by the time I was four or three.
Wow.
Yeah, four actually, because we moved to Coventry when I was four. And then we moved to Canada, and there was lots of sport and lots of busyness, you know. And my mum had to often be mum and dad if my dad had moved ahead somewhere. You know, she was always kind of packing up a house and moving on. And it was the three of us until I was 13. And then my little brother was born, who's no, not so little anymore. And he was, I think he was a bit of a surprise. I'm fairly sure he was a surprise, a lovely surprise, obviously. So the actual kind of memories I have of childhood are filled with sport, filled with kind of laughter, and young parents. You know, they were 23 when they had me, 26,
wow.
they had three kids. So they were busy doing their own social things at weekends, you know, lots of babysitters on a Saturday night. And we're very, very, very much like my mum getting glammed up at 7 o'clock on a Saturday night, and then they were out for the night. And we had some poor victim of a babysitter who we absolutely terrorised and told we were allowed to drink, you know. There was a green liqueur called Creme de Menthe. And I remember my mum coming home with three of us puking up all over the living room floor because we told this babysitter that it was a mint drink that we were allowed to have. We didn't know what it was, but we liked the look of it because it was in the drinks cabinet.
Right.
And, yeah, I don't think they had babysitters that came back. You know, there was always, because we were so close to the age, we were, you know, a year between each of us. So we just kind of, you know, ganged up together and we'd say, oh, yeah, no, we're allowed to bake cakes. You know, we're allowed to do this. So, yeah, fun times.
When you were younger, did you look ahead to the future and think that you would be a mum? Is that something, a role that you really wanted?
Yeah, I think I'm the eldest of four. We lost my brother Daniel when he was 15, but there were four of us for a few years at least, and three when I was growing up. And that felt like a busy house. And I loved that busyness. And I always wanted that for myself, you know, when I was...
Did you take on quite a maternal role with your siblings as well, do you think?
I think you look out for them all the time, I think. And I loved when Jordan was born and I was 13. That's a really interesting age to have a little baby brother. On the one hand, it gives you a real insight to, you know, how hard it is to have a baby. So the romantic notions of having a baby were out the window. And I
shattered.
There was no way I was being a teenage mum, because that was the best contraception my mum ever did. It was like, gosh, this is hard. And I remember one night saying, no, I'll have him tonight, because I could see she was tired. And by 2 o'clock in the morning, I was beaten. You know, I remember carrying him back to her room going, I can't do this. And I loved taking him in the buggy into Leeds. I'd say, can I go into Leeds with him today? When he was like one, you know, and I'd walk around, I'd get him on the bus. And me and my sister were chatting about this. My sister's 11 months younger than me. And we were chatting about this last year because she lives in America. And we're like, do you remember, she was 13, I was 14, and we used to get him on the bus and just walk around Leeds with him. Or we'd take him to York for the afternoon and things. My mum must have been so relaxed on a fourth child. She was just like, I don't think I'd have given my babies to a 13-year-old and said, go on, get on the train, have a nice afternoon.
No.
But it was a lovely way of experiencing being with a baby and having that, you know, relationship as a sibling, obviously, and knowing everything about him as a baby, you know, and seeing, you know, kind of how he was when he was teething or when he was being weaned, all those things that, you know, that you go on later on yourself. So I did, yeah, that certainly didn't put me off. It just put me off for a while, I think.
Yeah.
I thought I'd have more children, though. I always thought I'd have four children. So, and I just the other night said to Kenny, when we were talking about our empty house in the future, it's like, we should have had more children. And that's, you know, if not a regret, it was out of my control in many ways. But I often kind of think, oh, how come that happened? And I think I know how it happened, because when you have twins as your firstborn, you think life's going to get back to normal, and it never does. Yeah. and maybe that's the same with every baby, but we were waiting for that day where we felt everything's under control now. Now we can have another baby. And nothing ever gets back. You just kind of, we should have just gone for it almost straight away, you know, with another baby. But we were naively thinking that our old life of, you know, being a bit more kind of, I suppose, hedonistic and selfish was somehow going to come back.
But also, I think when you first start trying for a baby, because I know that Kenny really wanted to have kids young as well. Mm. When you first start, you're quite naive going into it. You know, you see people around you getting pregnant and it's all really, really simple and easy. And actually, that wasn't the case for you two.
No.
And what was the start of that journey like, and how quickly did you realise that it wasn't going to be as straightforward as you'd imagined?
We got married when I was 28, Kenny was 29, and we almost immediately wanted to try and start having a family. And which some of my girlfriends were really what are you going to do about your career? And they were a little bit shocked that I was thinking of this, because actually at that point they hadn't started yet. By the time we actually had Reuben and Lois, my best mate had three kids. another of those mates, you know, that I was talking to was onto her third pregnancy. So that time lag that happened was basically us not getting pregnant, naturally. And after a year, me starting to think, this isn't happening. What's going on? Then another 6 months or so went by when I started to pick up books in Waterstones and go, well, hang on a minute, let's flick to the pages of what I'm doing wrong. And I couldn't see what I was doing wrong. I was thinking, this isn't quite what I thought. And then that formal conversation you first have with a doctor where you discuss it. And because we were so young and healthy, they just kept saying things like, oh, just keep trying, you know. And it was, we weren't seen as urgent, I don't think, because we were still in our late 20s and tipping 30. And our lives were busy and fulfilled. You know, we had great, you know, jobs and we were enjoying life. So I think because of that, it looks on the outside sometimes, doesn't it? Like you're not really trying and you don't really want to start a family. So, you know, people perhaps didn't quite take seriously that ambition. And also you feel in your heart somehow you're failing and you don't want to always admit that you're not achieving this thing that seems so easy for everybody else. And so once we started on the voyage of discovery of what was going on inside my body and Kenny's body, and then we're told after some quite, you know, intrusive tests, oh, well, you're 20% of the people who have inexplained infertility. That was the most unsatisfying conversation ever, because
how do you fix that? What is that?
What does that mean? You know? And why have you not explained this for people? You know, but that was when we had to decide, okay, we're going to have some kind of intervention in the way we get pregnant. And we were given all these options of, you know, well, there's no reason your eggs are fine and his sperm's fine. There's no reason why you're not getting pregnant. You're just, and I had this image of everything being perfect apart from the point of, you know, conception of where the sperm and the egg meets, that at my eggs went, oh, and his sperm went, God. And then they both kind of ran away from each other. That was my kind of mental image of what was going on inside my body. And the, you know, can imagine the gynecologist, obstetrician going, no, it doesn't quite work like that. So
they get together, they have a little chat, yeah, and they're like, no, actually, you're not for me.
From one of four, Kenny's one of three. I was thinking this last night, actually, my female cousins have all got at least three children each, you know, so there was no sense of kind of in the family anywhere that this was a familiar problem, you know, or challenge. Nobody I knew in the family had any interventions with regard to getting pregnant, so I was on uncharted territory in that respect, and didn't really even talk to my mum about it.
Did you talk to anyone about it, or did you and Kenny just keep it to yourselves?
We pretty much kept it to ourselves. My very best friend, who had three babies by the time I had mine, who wasn't going to have, you know, any babies at all at that point, I talked to her, and she was, because she fell pregnant literally by just looking at her husband, she had not got a clue what IVF was, you know. So when I was expecting, she thought that I was somehow having, I remember her saying something that implied it was a surrogate baby. I said, no, this is my eggs and Kenny, and it's inside me, you know, because until you start exploring those things, you don't have the knowledge of them, do you? Why would you? So I was getting immersed in this world, obviously, of fertility. And then I did, we did embark on IVF, and we were very, very lucky, because I know it takes some women a long time to get pregnant, and we were first time. So it was, you know, very, very joyous. That whole image and kind of experience for me is not as fraught, and a lot of people I know find it very emotionally challenging and very physically challenging. But I guess because we were successful first time, it feels like a really positive experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And every fertility journey is so individual and personal, isn't it? And it's and I think you can take comfort from other people's stories, you know, whatever, you know, but it's so difficult knowing, well, that's not me, or you know, when there were so many different parts of that IVF journey. What was it like when your eggs were put, when the embryos were put back inside that day?
It was, I can picture everything about that day, and, you know, the journey back home and coming into the house thinking, I'm kind of pregnant, and, you know, not, and sitting down, Kenny being very attentive and wanting to make my dinner, and he was playing rugby in Glasgow in the last year of his career, and we were kind of moving between both cities, but there was no way that night he wanted me to fly back to Glasgow. So we went back to our house in London, and he was going to have to get a late plane back. And he was really lovely and made me some food, and he kind of went off, and I felt quite emotional. I was on my own in the house. And then I started to smell burning in the house. I thought, oh my God, what's going on? And I started walking. It was a townhouse. I started walking up the flights of stairs. And as I'm getting towards the top of the house, I could see a bit of smoke coming out of our bedroom, and stupidly opened the door because it could have been anything in there.
Yeah.
And it was filled. The whole room was filled with black ash kind of falling from the ceiling. There's clearly been a fire somewhere. And I was like, oh my God. And then thinking, is this smoke going to affect, you know, the chance of the babies or a baby surviving? And I walked towards the bathroom, and I could see red on it. I had a big long mirror. I could see red on this mirror. And I was like, what the hell is that on the mirror? And I opened the door to the bathroom, and all this smoke came out. To cut a long story short, Kenny had decided to turn on the heated towel rail and put my dressing gown on it because he wanted it to be warm for me when I went upstairs. We'd never used this towel rail before because it was quietly newly done out. It burnt itself out, caught fire to the dressing gown, caught fire basically. This was what all the ash was.
Oh,
we luckily had a fully tiled kind of limestone-y kind of bathroom. Nothing in there could catch fire. The red on the mirror was a letter he'd written to me in lipstick saying, I love you so much. You'll have, you know, we'll be great parents. This will be all great and all this. So this sinister thing that I thought was some kind of somebody's message. So this whole scene
really romantic that turned into a horror story.
Exactly. And he was by this point on the plane to Glasgow. So it was another 2 hours before I kind of got hold of him and said, oh, by the way, thanks for turning the heated towel rail on. You set fire to the bathroom and scared the living bejesus out of me when I saw the letter in the mirror. So I do remember the first day I got home very well, actually.
Oh my gosh. Oh my goodness. What were those next couple of weeks like? Because obviously you from that point you then just have to wait to see what the outcome is.
And again, not really telling, you know, anybody about it, because I thought if we've got to do this 5 times, I don't want this to be a constant. I don't want this to be me. This is all I am, is somebody who just keeps going through, you know, rounds of IVF. I want to have the rest of my life. I don't want this to overtake us or me. So I don't want to talk about it. So
is that because you thought that if you did share it, that people would want to talk to you about it?
Yeah.
Or did you just want to keep it something that's just you?
I just felt it was at that point, we just wanted it to just be us, because I just didn't want to. It wasn't that I didn't want to talk about it. And clearly I am now. And as soon as I was pregnant, I did. But I just wanted to get through this, not knowing if it was going to work, because I just didn't want to have to keep constantly being asked by every, you know, oh, are you on another round of IVF? How's it going? What's, you know, I thought, right, this is how we'll approach it for this time. And Kenny was really kind of with me on that as well.
Would it have added an extra element of pressure?
Yeah, it's expectation and all of that that's going on. And so, and none of my friends, if I'd had friends who'd been through IVF, I would have talked to them about it, but none of them had. So so that was, those few weeks were really nerve-wracking, actually. And I carried on working and doing, you know, kind of things. I didn't, you know, overexert myself, but I thought if I was pregnant naturally, I wouldn't know, and I wouldn't be stopping doing things. I was trying to behave normally, as normally as I, you know, as I could. And then on the day that I was due to, I had given a blood test on, I think, 7 or 8 weeks. And on the day I was due to get the results, because they do that early blood test, I've forgotten what the indicator is that tells you whether you're pregnant. But on that day that I was due the phone call, I woke up and I'd bled. And I was absolutely distraught. Kenny was in Glasgow and I rang him up and I said, I think we've lost the babies. I think, you know, this is... It's not happening. And he was so amazing. He was like, look, we'll go again and it's okay. We've learned a lot and this is, you know. And I just was like, right, this is, you know, just got to be kind of stoic about this and wait for that phone call. And the phone call came through later that day. And I've done that the wrong way around. The blood was on the day of the blood test. The phone call came the next day.
Right.
And because obviously if it was the day after, I'd have had a different result. But they said, oh, don't worry about that. You know, that can happen. You can have a bit of spotting. I mean, I wasn't obviously, you know, hemorrhaging, but I was sure that this was a sign. And they said, you're pregnant, basically. And they said something else to me on the phone. The doctor said something else to me on the phone, which was basically telling me that both eggs had taken, because he was talking about the numbers that were so high.
Right.
But I didn't get that in what he said, because I just heard that you're pregnant. That was enough, you know. I didn't care, you know, kind of like what that meant. It's just that you're pregnant was amazing. So, that was...
And you decided to put two eggs in instead of one?
That... Yeah, I think we just, you know, at the time it only just changed, I think, from... I think we could have still, at that point, you could still put three eggs in, I think, actually, back then. Because I had quite a few blastocysts as well. So we could have put three in, but we decided on two because of, you know, the risks of the pregnancy.
Mm.
And when we've had the first scan, I think at 10 weeks, there they were, two beating hearts. So, that was...
In a way, were you prepared for it being twins? Because you knew that, there were two eggs.
There was a chance, but it still was quite a thing, you know, to see that to see that on a screen and to think that's, you know, that, wow, that's amazing. And my best friend had twins, identical girls. She was due in the August, and this was the February. So, no, she'd had them in the August, sorry, and this was the February. So she had 6-month-old identical twins. So there was a bit of a
going. You knew what that life looked like.
And, well, she also had an 11-month-old. So she had three girls under 14 months when at that point. So, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
So I was thinking of her household going, oh, God, this is, how am I going to do this? So there was a bit of that. But it was weird. I remember thinking then, I had this kind of premonition when I was younger that I would have twins. You know, when you kind of look into your future. And I had this weird thing when I was a kid that I'd have twins, because I remember thinking about how ginormous pregnancy is with twins and how big you get, and being a bit scared of it. And then there I was, kind of, 20 weeks later, saying to my gynecologist, why am I hurting so much? And he said, because you're the size of a fully, full term pregnancy, and it's only 20 weeks. He said, your body's gone from 13 weeks, pretty much nothing, to 20 weeks, you're almost the same, circumference as a full term.
Yeah, and you think of all that stretching and shifting has to happen in a
short period of time. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, so I remember kind of going, God, nobody tells you this bit about you, what goes on in a twin pregnancy.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
What was the pregnancy like?
I had a really bad first trimester of headaches, bad headaches. And my doctor said, look, people don't talk about headaches. They talk about sickness. They never talk about it. But headaches is actually one of the second biggest kind of complaints. And you can take half an aspirin and it will either get rid of it or, unfortunately, you're stuck with it through the pregnancy.
Right.
And by the middle of the second trimester, I got rid of the headaches, thank God. But because I was so big, I was physically uncomfortable. I wasn't used to kind of that feeling of walking up the stairs and having to sit down halfway up the stairs. And, all those things that got kind of quite big quite quickly meant that I just practical things like, bending over, and all that happened so quickly and my body changed so quickly. I found that really hard to deal with. Not from a point of view of a visual kind of aesthetic thing, the practical side of life. Getting into the car, I had to change my car. I had a kind of Jaguar sports car and I had to get rid of it. I couldn't get into it. So that was all quite shocking. And, to me, I was like, oh my God, what's going on? And I didn't feel like I was still doing exercise and still walking. I was still able to move, but I just didn't feel comfortable. And I also found out I had this pain in my back, which I thought was to do with expansion. And I assumed it was my boobs growing. And I kept going and getting new bras and I kept buying Gaviscon and I trying to work out what it was that was this pain in my chest. And it was one of the twins had, one of the babies had kicked a rib out. And so it wasn't until I went to a physio, he said, unfortunately, I can't manipulate that back in because that releases oxytocin. He said, I could put you into labour at 26 weeks, which you don't want. So I had to then endure this horrific back pain, which the only time I ever experienced it again was when I did Strictly Come Dancing and James Jordan, my partner, made me do a kind of backward walkover. And I went, ow, I know that pain. And I popped a rib then as well. So, I'm pretty sure it was Ruben because it was the baby who was head down who'd done it.
We'll blame Ruben. Yeah. It's fine.
It was quite a kind of uncomfortable. I remember one night ringing my mum going, oh God, I feel really uncomfortable. She went, am I only getting 2 grandchildren? Because I was obviously moaning. But
How were you emotionally? Because obviously when you've been on a journey and it's taken time to get pregnant, for me, I felt like I was worried. And I have been worried every single pregnancy. I feel like each day is like a take a breath. We've got through that day.
Was it similar
for you?
I was very after, especially when I got to 30, late 20 weeks, because my friend had had hers at 34, and I was due to get induced. If I got to 38, they would induce me because my obstetrician didn't want you to go beyond 38 weeks. And so every week then after the late 20s, I was listening to my body all the time, thinking, is this the day that, something's going to happen? Or can I hear anything? Can I feel anything today? Something, you know, I did have one moment where I rushed myself in and wanted a scan because I was sure that everything had stopped. You know, I couldn't feel them. And when you've got two babies moving and there's no movement, then you really start to panic because you can have a lot of movement some days, a lot of feet kind of, you know, prodding out. And then it was just very, very quiet that day. And Kenny was away somewhere that day and he was playing in a charity golf day in Newcastle, I think. And he said, just go and see him and don't worry. Just, he won't mind. And so I think I probably was a bit more anxious than say if I hadn't gone through the process of IVF and everything else, maybe that probably added to the anxiety, I think. But I had, you know, a brilliant obstetrician who was just so, you know, he specialised in multiple births and he just would reassure me a lot. And I wanted to try and enjoy those final few weeks if I could. And knowing that life was going to change beyond all recognition. So overall, I would say, you know, kind of look back and think actually it was a really happy time. I did the Champions League final in Istanbul when I was 30 weeks pregnant. So it was ginormous. I can't believe I went on television in this, you know, this suit that kind of like I'd had specially made that was like a tent that hung. I thought I was absolutely smashing it. And I look back at the picture, I'm like, I had a space hopper at my jumper, you know. And the reason Kenny came out for that match was because I was told that they could try and stop me flying home because I was on the cusp of when you have to cut off, you know, flying. Because I was so big, they thought I was 9 months pregnant and they weren't going to let me on the plane. They were saying, no, you can't fly. And Kenny had to, you know, kind of say, no, I'm her husband. She's okay. And so after that, I kind of wound down my work and just tried to kind of really nest and get, you know, get everything ready. Because I did think they'd come early because they were twins, you know. But the opposite happened. I was 38 weeks and my obstetrician was 37 and he said, do you know what? We can go on a bit longer. And I went, no, you've told me you were going to induce me on the 27th of July and that is when I'm getting induced. Because I mentally, it was like a kind of, you know, this beacon of hope in the horizon. The 27th of July is the date and I'm not going a day. Well, I did go a day longer because they didn't come out until the 28th. But
I wonder if that's also seeing the finish line. And if you've got that in your vision and in your mind the whole time, for it to suddenly be moved, you've not been training for that.
No,
the training has stopped
for that. Yeah, that's the day of competition. That's the baby Olympics, and that's when I'm competing. So he was like, "All right, okay."
What did it feel like when you were going in to be induced?
We went that morning, we went for breakfast somewhere together and had this kind of, right, this is it, you know, we're on the edge of, you know, our life's changing and having that day feeling, packing my bag and all those things and feeling like this is, you know, this is, we're in control, this is all great, this is the plan and everything. And then getting into hospital and being induced, suddenly everything kind of just goes out the window, doesn't it? Because you're no longer really in control of what's happening. Mm-hmm. Kenny, it was about 7 o'clock in the evening they got me in because they said it won't work first time, it never does. So we'll get you in and induce you. And if nothing's happening, you stay the night, we can monitor you. And Kenny comes back in the morning. Only he went home and about 2 hours later, I went into full blown labour. But I left it a couple of hours. I started doing all my breathing and my, you know, I thought I can't call everybody now. It's 11 o'clock. I've got to let them all, you know. And eventually about 1 a.m, I went to reception and I said to this amazing midwife, I said, I think I'm in labour. She went, yes, dear, that's why you came here. And she was very matter of fact about it. She said, go back to bed, keep doing what you're doing. We'll just see how you are. We'll monitor you. And then I rang Kenny eventually and I said, I'm in labour. Would you like to come back? And he's like, why didn't you ring me straight away? And then I rang my obstetrician. And then
I don't want to bother everyone, but there might be two babies coming out very soon.
There's a couple of things going on here. But unfortunately, it was 24 hours later before I actually gave birth because like a lot of women who are induced and you only start reading these things after, don't you? It can just then slow down dramatically. And after about 12 hours, it just was tailing off. And my obstetrician had made a deal with me that I was determined I wanted a natural birth. And he said, okay, you've got to have an epidural because if we have to intervene, which we do often with multiple births, we want to be sure that we can, you know, get the pain relief in and everything, he said. So he did that in the early part of the afternoon. And that's when it all just tailed off. And I felt like I was wasting it. I was like, what's going on? Nothing's happening now. It's all really slow. I'm not dilating. And about 7 o'clock, he said to me, I'm really sorry, he said, but you've been in labour now for 20 hours. We're going to have to, you know, get ready for a cesarean. I know it's not what you were hoping for, but that's what we're going to do. And I said, OK. And Kenny said, right, I'm going to go off and leave you on your own to just have some time. And he went off to the room that I'd been in before to watch Emmerdale. That was and my parents had arrived by this point with my brother, and they were in another waiting room. And I was lying there on this bed in this hospital room on my own, thinking, you know how you do this with your mental state, going, right, no, this is for the best, this is for the babies, this is all about them, this is not about me. And you know, this is and I was really kind of getting my mind focused on that. And then my midwife came in and she went, oh my God, you've gone from 4 to 10 centimetres in an hour. We're going to have to get these babies out. You're going to have to push. And I was like, what? And so...
Do you think it's because in that moment you almost relaxed?
Yeah, I'm sure it is. And just thought, well, I'll let them do whatever it is they have to do. And so, yeah, so eventually, I mean, it was a few hours later that they came out, and within 16 minutes of each other.
Oh, who came first?
Reuben. He was head first. And so... She was breech, and they assumed that she would kind of flip. That often happens. The baby who's head first comes out, and then the other one kind of turns because they've got loads more space. But she didn't turn. So he came out quite easy. Not easy at all. I mean, not easy. What I mean is without too much kind of, I think he must have had a forceps or something to help him a little bit, but he was, you know, he was okay. And everything was fine. And then I thought I'd have a cup of tea and maybe a piece of cake and just chill for a bit. And I'm putting him on my skin and Kenny's putting him on his skin. And then my obstetrician, who's this Australian guy, goes, all right, Gabby, I think we're going to get on with this. Yeah, okay. Because he's obviously looking at me like, does she think this is it? You know.
And has she forgotten there's another one?
Some water. She didn't turn. So she was delivered breech, which obviously is very, very rare. So she,
what came out first then?
Her feet. She came out feet first. So her feet dropped down and obviously she was guided out then. So... breech babies don't cry straight away because they're quite shocked. so they took ages. She took ages to cry and took ages to get a kind of her air. Well, it felt like ages, you know. So so that was a bit of a moment where they were kind of going, okay, right. Is she okay? Yeah, she's fine. She's fine. I'm like, I can't hear her.
Yeah.
Obviously, eventually then she did. And they put them in that, you know, those little kind of like washing up bowls. And they were there, lying there in the washing up bowl. Unfortunately, I didn't fare quite so well. I had a bit of a hemorrhage, but and so I was kind of rushed into theatre then.
Was that straight away?
Yeah, well, I didn't distend, basically, which again, here's one for the listeners. The chapter in the book that I'd been reading about twin births did have clearly a lot of information about how twin births sometimes don't distend, but I'd ignored all of that because I wanted to wash over the kind of, you know, the bits that I didn't want to know, as you
That's
do.
Not pretty. I just want to know
exactly,
about the kids.
Yeah.
Where's the babies?
So it's something that can happen. And obviously you're injected then with heparin to try and induce that, but it just, the heparin wasn't working. And... Kenny was scrubbed up. Everybody had to kind of scrub up, and I was wheeled past my poor parents who'd seen the first baby. Kenny had rushed out with Reuben and shown them Reuben, but never came out with Lois because this all happened so quickly. So they were thinking something was happening with the second baby. And meanwhile, I'm then being wheeled down the corridor and they're going, oh my God. So my mum went into the room where the babies had been left, because they were on their own at this point, and somebody was in trying to mop up all the gory stuff that was on the floor. And so she just kind of came in and saw her first grandchildren lying there. And then I was reunited with them about 2.5 hours later in a bay, kind of, you know, 2:30 in the morning. So
did you have to have... Did you have to have general anaesthetic to
well,
did you have to...
luckily, because of my deal with my obstetrician, I had
epidural,
so they were able to pump in more pain relief at that point. And I was very close to completely passing out. I was losing, you know, I'd lost so much blood. I'd lost almost half the blood in my body eventually. So I had a massive hemorrhage, and I was lying there kind of thinking, I'm going to sleep, like I'm gone. You know, and Kenny said my face just went white. And I was, you know, and I heard him say, is she going to make it? Basically to ask my obstetrician. And he says, he didn't tell me this straight away, but he said he was stood there thinking, I've got two babies and I'm about to lose my wife. I'm going to become a father and they're going to lose their mother. You know, he could, because the drama of the whole situation happened so quickly, you know, with the crash button being pressed and people kind of coming in, because I had to have, you know, lots of people in there doing their various jobs, and suddenly gone from this nice room that had a whirlpool jacuzzi in it, which we obviously weren't allowed to use with twins, but they had, you know, the whole kind of, it wasn't totally serene, but it was a much more relaxed birth room, and then into theatre. For what happened next. So, and had to have a massive blood transfusion. And it meant then, obviously, I had to stay in hospital a bit longer than I was hoping to, because I wanted to be out really quickly. And I had to stay for a week in the end. So I then got completely institutionalised. I never wanted to leave. I had to practice walking down the steps the night before I left, because I couldn't imagine leaving this haven of kind of these lovely midwives and this safe environment. I was like, I don't want to go home ever.
And also, they're kind of helping you within those early days. Well, and suddenly we go, well, now I've got to do it on my own. But we had such a nice system set up.
I was just pressing this buzzer and you were coming to help me. And then, where do you live? Can you be round in 20 minutes? Because I'd had this, I'd been awake for 2 days by the time, almost, like I was awake for 3 hours short of 2 days by the time I got into the bay. And I remember the midwife saying, or another nurse saying, okay, do you want to breastfeed them? And I went, can I be honest? No, I said, I'm exhausted. And my mum pulled out this cheese sandwich she'd made, and it was in her bag, and it was the best thing ever. You know, I was absolutely starving. I hadn't eaten for about 2 days. I remember eating this cheese sandwich, and the babies were lying there. And I said, can I start tomorrow? Can I start being a mum in the morning?
You take on the biggest role of your life when you are at your most depleted, in every single sense.
I know. Mother Nature really hasn't worked that one out. I remember thinking afterwards, what should happen is a baby should come out in a kind of little cocoon thing, and it takes about 3 weeks to burst out properly, and you get your
like
strength
an egg,
and energy.
Gabby.
Yes, exactly. And then we go, okay, let's get on with this now. We're all good. Everybody's ready to go. So, yeah, it wasn't exactly that, but it wasn't how I'd imagined it.
One thing you've had with Reuben and Lois is they have now, unfortunately, fortunately surpassed the age that Daniel was when he died. That must be a very weird part of your grief as well, because obviously, you've lost him as a sister, but now that your kids have been a similar to age to him, does that make you look at your mum in a different light and what she would have experienced?
Especially the year where Reuben became older than the age that Daniel was, more Reuben than Lois, because of that kind of first of all, a strong kind of link, the way they look, you know, facially and everything, but also. He's really, you know, good at sport, Rubes, and he plays rugby, and Daniel was a footballer, and it was all those kinds of similarities. And leading up to his 16th birthday, which was 2 months before Daniel was 16 when he died, I didn't realise how much I'd carried that anxiety, actually, about him turning that age and getting past that age almost. And that's not to say that, you know, anything can happen at any time, obviously. Yep. I'm not, you know, not naive enough to think that, but it was obviously symbolic for me, I think, more than I realised that he, you know, to get, and as you say, then putting myself in my mum's shoes at that age and seeing, you know, his development beyond those years and, you know, how all those things were missed out. And obviously, Jordan went through, you know, his 16th birthday as well a few years later. But I think probably becoming a mum was more the moment where I really thought about that loss a lot more. But then, of course, when they're babies, you're not seeing the character. They're not talking to you. You don't have that. So the older they get, the more impact they've had on your lives, haven't they? In terms of, it doesn't mean that grief and loss is any different, but I suppose it's then the feeling of the person that they were becoming and that they would be, and all those things that you know, carry through your grieving process, which I think was, it hit hard around his 16th birthday. Sure.
Yeah. In every episode, I ask you if you could write a letter on motherhood, who would it be to and what would you say?
I'd be torn between writing to my mum and writing to my two, actually.
Yeah.
Probably write to my two, because I asked them, knowing I was doing this today, I asked them yesterday for 5 bullet points each of good things and bad things about me as a mum, which was brutal, as you can imagine.
So you're in an assessment.
Yeah.
So.
And you know you haven't got stuff right, and you know there are things that you could have done better, and there are things that you were doing with absolutely the best will in the world, but you might have just, overstepped the mark or not quite, you know, got the tone right. And
yeah,
or times that you've lost your patience when you, you know, you should have just tried to be a little bit more in the moment. Mm-hmm. And I suppose the letter would be not asking for forgiveness at all, because I don't want to kind of sound like I'm, you know, looking to be, you know, kind of this exonerated, perfect, you know, mum. But feeling like actually, I know it didn't. I didn't always get these things right, but hopefully, you know, there's enough that was okay there that you feel, you know, that you've had a great time being mothered by me, and that you know that we've got the balance right. So I suppose it would be a bit about that. And I suppose if it was to them at this age now, they might look on it themselves when they become parents and not put huge expectations on themselves to be, you know, to be perfect, because we don't all get it right. Funnily enough, when I was, you talked about being emotional when I was pregnant, I was watching Glastonbury the summer, about a month, it must have been a month before they were born. And I remember being really emotional. I can't remember what act was on that I was. I wasn't at Glastonbury. Can I just say that? I wasn't 8 months pregnant at Glastonbury. I was watching it on the good old BBC. And I got really emotional watching an act and decided to write a letter to them. And I sealed it ready for their 21st birthday. And it's in a box in my office right now. And I have no idea what I wrote because I've never opened it. And they know it's there, but they're not going to open it until they're 21. And I wonder how much I can't remember what I was writing, but I wonder how much I was in that letter writing about kind of how I hope to be as a mum. maybe I didn't, you know, live up to all those hopes. But I think I would write to them. Yeah.
We end the podcast with you completing three sentences. The first one is, being a mum means.
Being a mum means everything. It's the most all-encompassing job and task and privilege and joy, I think. It doesn't matter what else is going on in your life. It is the thing that kind of predicates all your decisions. It gives you a perspective on everything that you do. And I'm so glad. It took a bit of effort, but I'm so glad we got there. Since having children, I am probably a better person, actually. I'm probably a bit more, I won't say patient, but I'm probably better for having children. I definitely feel I look at the world in a different way. So they've made me better.
I love that. I would say patient, but I can't. Because the kids might listen and be like, no. And finally, I'm happy when?
I'm happy when my gang are all together. I'm happy when we usually sometime on a Sunday, whether it's a late lunch or, you know, we eat all our meals pretty much together at home, but you don't always have that proper conversation time. And it's usually at the weekend when we really sit down for a big meal together and we're chewing the fat, literally and metaphorically, about life, and they are the times I feel happiest, I think.
Yeah, I love that. Gabby, thank you so much. I've absolutely loved chatting to you.
And you too. Thank you so much for having me. And it's a great podcast.